In episode 10, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Robin West and dive deeper into return-to-play decision-making, including criteria for clearance and novel treatments to expedite return.
We'll start our discussion today with a systematic review and meta-analysis titled Return to Competition Criteria After Ulnar Collateral Ligament Reconstruction from the June issue of AJSM this year. Chris Ahmad and his team at Columbia University found that there is minimal literature describing the return-to-play process after UCL reconstruction. There is currently no validated or universally accepted guidelines for determining when an athlete is safe to return to play. The authors found only three specific criteria across all studies. Completion of a return to throwing program was the most frequently used criterion, followed by time from surgery, and lastly, completion of a return to mound program for pitchers. 9 months from surgery was the most common time point used. No study mentioned return to play criteria relating to pain, motion, strength, endurance, balance, coordination, or fear of re-injury.
Then, from the April 2020 issue of OJSM, we wrap up with the publication, Platelet-Rich Plasma Shortens Return to Play in NFL Players with Acute Hamstring Injuries.
Jim Bradley and colleagues at UPMC reported that leukocyte-poor PRP injections allowed for faster return to play in athletes with grade 2 hamstring injuries, with a one-game overall difference. There was no difference in total days missed or time to return to practice. The authors recommend using PRP with a low platelet count and low leukocyte count, as PRP preparations rich in platelets and leukocytes may lead to increased local reaction and subsequent scarring, increasing the risk of re-injury. So that was a good discussion on psychological barriers. We talked a bit, you know, about that. And so the third paper we had referenced was the systematic review looking at return to play criteria. So now kind of back to that, like, physical criteria for returning to play after a UCL injury by Chris Ahmad and his group. And I was pretty surprised by the results of this, that they found that out of all the papers they reviewed, there were only three criteria that they found across all the literature. And I just found that really incredible, given the amount of literature that's on UCL. I feel like there's like tens of papers on, you know, different graft choices and different surgical techniques, but there's no structured return to play. Did this surprise you at all, Robin, looking at this? Or do you feel like this is pretty standard, that there's not really a structured return to play checklist like there is for ACL for a variety of other injuries that we may deal with our athletes?
It didn't really surprise me. Again, I think that, you know, UCL reconstructions are common in a very specific group, right? And we know in pitchers, that's the patients we're going to see it in. And so it's maybe not as common. We're not seeing it as widespread. So the studies are going to be very specific and done at certain locations or people who have access to those kind of patients. So that may be one of the reasons why we're not seeing really clear criteria on what is the return to play. You know, we know it's time is one of the right examination, range of motion, and then maybe the following this throwing protocol.
Yeah.
But again, even the throwing protocol is so variable. And it really depends on again, the position, on the physical therapist who's rehabbing them, on their coach. So I wasn't surprised. I mean, it would be very helpful, I think. You know, I think when we take care of a team and we have a lot of athletes with UCL reconstructions, every team has their own little protocol that they use, but it's not well published, right?
That's what they asked for, right? At the end, they said, we need more transparency in the literature about postoperative rehab and protocols. So that is, it probably is out there. It's just not out there for, you know, for everyone to see.
Yeah. Is it because of competition or is it, I think there are a lot of variables.
Yeah.
People don't want to share the secrets.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody has their little secret sauce. Do you have any, for your work in baseball, do you have any sort of things that you're looking for when you're specifically to a pitcher, whether or not it's UCL or it's something else? Do you have any sort of like mental checklist that you work through to make sure they're hitting?
Catherine, you know, it's on the professional side, and actually really on any patient I take care of, I really work with the whole team because I see them. I always tell patients, I see you in the office. I look at your range of motion. I look at your given effusion. I look at your strength, and I can do my little assessment in the office and do a single leg squat or test their forearm strength or their stability or their UCL, or I can do an ultrasound and look at, do they have, how much opening do they have with valgus stress testing? But at that point, then I'm kind of done really. I mean, I'm not the one on the field with them. So I am a big believer in communicating. So I communicate again with the athletic trainer, the physical therapist, our strength and conditioning coach, and I get their feedback and I listen to their feedback and their concerns. because they're the ones who can tell me right away, hey, they have a concern because of this. And it's amazing to me, the things that they look for, you know, from throwing form to strength, to flexibility, to mobility. So they've got so many aspects and taking that all into consideration. I always tell the patient, my part is like an hour long. I take it, do a little surgery, and then you guys are on your way. And now it's really the rest of the team. And then it's gathering all that information and deciding.
Robin, you and I have spoken before, and you gave me some really helpful advice about how to set up communication when you're working as a team physician. Do you mind sharing? Because Ashley is now working. She's working with US Gymnastics. And I know she'd probably benefit, as would other people listening, about, you know, how you sort of set up that structure and make sure everybody's communicating well. Because I know I learned a lot.
Yeah, I think it's variable. Depends on what you're doing, what team you're taking care of. Everyone has different, you're working with a high school team, are you working with a club team who doesn't necessarily have an athletic trainer? So there are different variables that you have to think of. I think communication all around is key. So if you're working with a club team and you don't really have, you have the coach and yourself and the parents, right? Then you need to communicate with those people that you're working directly with. But for me, identifying the therapist who's taking care of the patient. So my patients in my office, I need to communicate with them. And whether it's via email, by cell phone, whatever it is, we establish that and say upfront, call me anytime. Like, I need to know. I want to know earlier. I want to know at week six, not at 6 months out, if there's a problem. Let me know soon so we can take care of it. Any concerns? And they're the ones who are seeing the patient several times a week. I'm seeing them every, you know, month. So I think that's important, because we need to establish that. And taking care of a professional team, it's different, and it's structured very differently for every team you take care of. You may have the athletic trainer in charge, strength and conditioning coach may be in charge, physical therapist, sort of in charge of the medical team. And yeah, I always say I play a small role in it. But again, my role is I have to give the final clearance as a physician. And so, but how do we establish that? How do we decide that? And that's working together. But I do think it's important, and just trying to figure out, hey, what works best? Is it text message? Is it email? Is it calling? And what works for the people that you're communicating with?
I think you bring up a very good point there. I feel like the most effective teams that I've seen are made up of the experts in that area of their specific area, all working together. You know, you mentioned like strength and conditioning, like athletic training, like a director of rehab, you as the orthopedic surgeon, maybe even non-op sports person as well too, from like the initial non-operative management or injection side of things. And it's like, if everyone brings their expertise together and then communicates effectively, I feel like that yields the best, rather than one person trying to manage everything. Like Catherine knows a lot about PT because she was a PT prior to going to medical school, but my PT knowledge base is not that established compared to Catherine's. And so I still have a lot to learn. So they're really the experts. So I think you raised a very good point about communicating within that team.
You know, the interesting thing is also I've been surprised just how the other players know, and how the coaches will know, and how the GM will grab me sometimes. I mean, even and just say, hey, I've got a concern. I remember one of the first games when I was taking care of the Washington football team, one of the players grabbed me and said, hey, listen, doc, so-and-so doesn't look right on the field. Like they're just not acting right. He goes, I was out there and he's not recalling the plays. And so he grabbed me and there was no hit. We didn't see anything. Went back to the replays. But the athlete came to me and said, and so we do an evaluation. The kid had a concussion. But again, it was his recognition of it. There was no hit. There was nothing that we saw, right? But when you're in a pile up and you don't really see the mechanism. And so again, listening to everybody and communicating, or the GM for a baseball team will come to me and say, hey, something's not right. You know, this pitcher, his velo's down. Like, you know, he was pitching 96, 97 all last month. And this month he's down 93, 94. And so he will pull me aside and say, something's not right. And so lo and behold, you know.
Robin,
so things, you have to be open to those conversations. I am not the expert. I'll never claim that I'm the expert on identifying all those.
Yeah, Robin, I think that's an awesome point. I think that just shows, like, you know, if people are coming to you, they know, okay, she's amenable to me speaking up. And it's sort of setting that tone. And, you know, I know that for professional lacrosse, like I always sort of check in with the referees too before and say, if you see something I don't see, I want you to tell me, you know, and they have, and, you know, they'll say, I think he got hit in the head and da, 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 you know, but you know, but I also think that shows a lot about your leadership. If you're getting the GM coming to talk to you, they always feel comfortable. You have to rely on everybody to help and pitch in and just sort of know that, you know, just because you might be making that final decision, there's probably lots of people around you who have some really helpful input.
I agree. And I like you said, being open and also doing something about it. It's funny how many phone calls I get from the players and say, hey, listen, my son has a stuffy nose and my, or whatever. Like I tell them I'm the orthopedic surgeon. Yeah, no, we know doc, but we know you're going to help us. So, again, it's just that the openness to come tell you or calling me about other things that I, you know, won't talk, share online, yeah. online here, but, and hey, how do I help direct them to the right person? And so again, having that network of people, I think that's the most important thing. Get that network so you can help identify. And again, like you said, Catherine, have people come up to you, you know, whether it is the cleaning person, whoever it is, because people mm-hmm. see things that
yeah.
we don't always get.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Very good advice. So what do we think? Do we want to transition to talking about PRP, kind of that side, biologic side of things? Okay, awesome.
Yeah, so I think we have you for like another, you know, 15, 20. So,
yeah, so that's
what we're going to talk about.
So this is the James Bradley paper. I think you know him, Robin. and it was the paper looking at PRP for acute grade 2 hamstring injuries. And they found an earlier return to play by one game, but otherwise pretty comparable results. So what are your thoughts on PRP for acute hamstring injuries? Do you routinely do it? Do you offer it to players? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I was with Jim actually when we started doing PRP. We had just actually it was when we were playing in the Super Bowl, and Hines Ward had an MCL injury, and the PRP, the ACP, the arthritis product had just come out, and so Hines was trying to get back. It was 2 weeks out, you know, from the Super Bowl, and he was like, "I have to get back, and what are we going to do?" And hey, we have this new product, we could try it. It may help you, it may not, and it's, you know, really low risk, and so we try that. And. And it was interesting because the next day after we won the Super Bowl, and on the cover of the New York Times is Hines Ward says PRP won the game. And that's kind of, then all of a sudden the phone starts ringing. We have to do PRP. It's so crazy. But so that was in 2009. And so anyway, from then on, there's been a significant, you know, production in the literature of PRP. I'm a big fan of it for hamstring injuries, you know, for those grade 2 hamstring injuries. I do believe it works as Jim showed in that paper, that return to play by one game in the NFL is a huge, huge deal. And so even though it's only a couple days return to play, if you look at time frame, but on game time, it's a big deal. And so, you know, before that steroids were used, right? Doing a steroid into the hamstring defect, and the literature supported it. I mean, it was really supported. It returned to play was quicker. Re-injury rate was lower. But steroid to me is always, there's always, I hate using steroids on if we don't have to, right? There are other anabolic effects or catabolic effects that we're concerned about, at least around the cartilage and tendon. So I am a fan of PRP. Typically what I do is I'll ultrasound, we get an MRI, and then we ultrasound that, if, especially if there's a hematoma, because they often have an associated hematoma. And you can see that develop in about 24 to 48 hours after the injury. So aspirate that hematoma under ultrasound and then inject the PRP. That aspiration of the hematoma, I think, helps dramatically. It really makes a difference. They notice immediately.
Yeah. Robin, do you notice anecdotally, like, who does better with PRP and hamstrings as far as, you know, a more of a high hamstrings, more distal, more muscular tendinous?
More that mild tendinous junction, and the proximal ones are typically harder to deal with. Obviously, we're concerned on the surgical side too. They're very proximal, and the distal ones linger. So it's more of the mild tendinous ones that seem to respond.
As an aside, you mentioned MRI. So I feel like all like elite athletes like NFL or MLB, they're all getting MRIs just to look at it and see, you know, could kind of degrade it. Now, if you have like a high school athlete, it's classic hamstring strain, some bruising, but it doesn't seem proximal, it seems mid. Are you getting hamstring MRIs and all of those as well too, just to look at them and give prognosis or not?
You know, it depends, Ashley, on the sport and where they are in the season, and so that it really depends a lot. And I think timing's important, because if somebody's looking to make playoffs or they're looking for a college scholarship, then I'll be a little more aggressive about getting an MRI. Mm-hmm. we have ultrasound in our office, so we can use ultrasound also for diagnostic purposes. But I do find the MRI criteria, grading criteria is better. You know, we know that the grade ones are going to take this long, grade twos are going to take this long based on, and those grading, that grade is based on the size of the defect, right? The associated hematoma. So lots of things that we look at. On an ultrasound, it's hard to really grade them. Mm-hmm. So if we're not looking to get an MRI, we'll ultrasound in the office. If we are, again, timing wise, because of the season or the sport or college scholarship, whatever it is, then we'll get an MRI.
And for the ones that you are doing an injection, a PRP injection, Robin, are you generally planning on doing more than one, or, you know, sort of how do you make those decisions?
Yeah, it's one to two, I'd say, and they're spaced about a week apart. Typically for those grade one to two injuries, just one seems to work well. And I haven't gone on to more, but the more significant injuries, those grade two to three injuries, we'll often do two.
Okay.
Are you adding BFR to your rehab after doing like this, the PRP acutely, or waiting a bit prior to doing the certain number of injections?
Yeah, we use a lot of BFR, Ashley. I typically allow just a couple of days, about a 48-hour time period before we really start getting aggressive with it. So again, that's on the PT side, but I'm a fan of it. So I would support using it at about 48 hours afterwards.
Okay. And my last sort of question on the PRP front is beyond the hamstring, what other areas in your elite athletes have you found like, oh, this is a pretty effective thing in an acute setting?
UCL injuries, so proximal UCL injuries. Had a lot of success with it.
Okay.
And so those are probably the two main things that I'd say. And we use stem cells for some things. And again, you know, what's what, and there's such variability in the PRP products. We know that our platelets vary from day to day. You know, our PRP that you make today may be different than tomorrow. So I think that makes it hard to study. And same thing with the stem cells. When you look at, especially all the allogenic stem cells on the market, which are now being recalled by the FDA, but even our own iliac crest stem cells or adipose stem cells. But I find that tendons typically do better without like a chronic patellar tendonitis. I've had better luck using BMAC for.
Okay.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for answering all these questions for us and going through this with us. It's a great discussion. So really appreciate it, especially your insight on team dynamics and how to build a successful sports medicine team. We really appreciate that.
We're happy to discuss it.
Definitely. Catherine, do you want to kick off the fast five that we have?
Okay. In the OR, do you use foot pedal or hand control?
Hand control.
Oh, yes. Okay. Everyone's been saying foot pedal.
Oh, really? Do you guys use hand control?
I use hand control. I use hand control because I'm vertically challenged. So I can't do foot pedals when I'm doing shoulder, or else I have to make like a boardwalk of like elevation. So I learned hand with shoulder. And so I just do it for knee as well too. But
yeah, it's funny because I train fellows and residents and they have trouble with the hand control. I'm like, really? I don't understand. Like the foot control and the pedal gets in the way. And
yep, I completely agree. Shoes in the OR. What are your favorite?
I wear clogs, dance goes.
Nice, dance goes.
How about you guys?
I probably would be vertically challenged since like my second year of residency. I've worn Hunter wedge boots.
I wear Calzeros. Funny, I used to wear dance goes, but they were doing this campaign. I was like a second year resident at Brigham and they were giving them free to residents to wear them to try to like overtake Dansko. And they can be autoclaved. So I liked that after like a trauma thing, if like it went through the boots or something, I could just throw them in the autoclave.
Yeah,
so I wear these bright pink Calzeros. I'm on like my
Calzero. I'm going to look at that. How do you spell it?
It's Calzurro. Calzeros.
All right, I'll check them out.
They come in like all these different colors. It's nice. They have a little bit of an elevation, not as much as like Catherine's wedge booty, but
they're comfortable.
Yeah.
Okay. What is your favorite OR lounge snack?
I bring nuts mostly. So if I'm in the OR lounge, I'll grab some graham crackers. But if I am bringing something, like today I was in the OR all day and I just will bring a little bag of nuts and just have it in between cases. But if I'm going to go raid their thing, then I'll, you know, grab one of the little graham crackers. How about you guys?
Yeah. Our surgery center has awesome stuff now. So they have like the Ritz crackers with peanut butter. They have little sized ones. Oh, they're so good. Like I used to take the little crackers and dip them in peanut butter at MGH. Like you remember that, Catherine, right? By like the OR, but these are actually like the pre-made ones. It's very cool.
One I remember was, do you remember at the BI? So when we were at Beth Israel, they had cookies and I can't remember what they were. But they were like really high sugar. They'd make you feel like garbage, but they were so good.
The shortbread ones? Were they the shortbread ones?
Yeah.
Patients would come back to clinic and be like, I'd be like, how are you doing? They're like, good, good. So these cookies that I had in the post-operative area, I need to know what they are so I can buy them. I'd be like, that's the question that you have for me today. So they really like them. Big fan. And then not last question, because that's only four. What music do you play in the OR?
Kid Rock.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wow. Like Kid Rock Pandora station or just like all Kid Rock?
Yeah, like a Pandora Kid Rock
station. Nice.
That's really fun. I saw him live once and it was with like Run DMC. So it was like a little crossover show.
Yeah.
It was super fun.
Old school.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm going to try that out tomorrow. What is your favorite surgery?
I like doing big cases actually. So I kind of get bored after doing labral repairs and ACLs. And so, like a couple of weeks ago, I did a fun surgery, and this is probably a surgery that I would love to do. I did a distal femoral osteotomy along with a tibial tubercle osteotomy, revision MPFL, and a biopatellar OATS.
Ooh, that's a very fun case.
A 15-year-old girl who had a horrible MPFL done 2 years prior. She had her growth plate disrupted, had a recurrent patellar dislocation. I mean, so it was dislocated, chronically dislocated, and she had 12 degrees of valgus. And so it's honestly a horrible situation for her, but it was a fun surgery to correct everything and to mm-hmm. see her on that table and see her post-op and have her look good and feel good. So I like doing those big cases occasionally. Those are not my everyday things, but I like doing cases like that.
So curiosity, like detail about the MPFL, what was the initial sort of fixation, and was it a graft or just a primary repair, or what did they do?
It was a graft. Yeah, it was done when she was 13, and they must have disrupted her physis when they came across because she had such significant valgus alignment compared to the contralateral side.
Okay.
Her tunnel was very anterior, and so I'm not sure what they were trying to do, if they were trying to avoid her growth plate or what happened, but
yeah.
So she came to me and she had no articular cartilage under her patella at all because she had been chronically dislocated. So she was lucky enough that she was old enough and she developed her trochlea. It wasn't like she was so young that she never developed her trochlea and she stayed dislocated because of that. It was more.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one. That is.
Yeah. I always like doing HTOs and bigger cases. Again, not every day, but yeah. Like to throw them in sometimes to add a little spice.
That's good. That's good.
Definitely.
Well, we really appreciate you taking time today. We really enjoyed watching you speak at AOSSM and, you know, following along and seeing all the things you're doing as a team physician. Are really remarkable just how you handle yourself and hold yourself. And, you know, people obviously have a great deal of respect for you in the sports world. So we really thank you for sharing time with us today.
Catherine, Ashley, thank you so much for having me. You guys are doing a great job, and I'll have to listen to all your podcasts now. Listen to OR.
Just a mix of Kid Rock and
exactly.
podcast. Right, Kid Rock. Exactly. I love it.
Love that.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great rest of your night. Take care, Rob.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to episode 10 of the Sports Docs podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as we did. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod. Stay fit, friends.